The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
Welcome back to the 9 till noon show. It's Michaela Clark in this morning for Greg Hughes. We're into the final hour of this show. We're talking now about the Irish Heart Foundation calling for a smoking ban on a number of public spaces. To discuss this, I am joined by Mark Murphy, who is Senior Policy Manager at the Irish Heart Foundation. Good morning to you, Mark.
Good morning.
So, Mark, where have these calls come from? This is obviously something that does affect quite a high volume of people.
Yes, absolutely. So the reason why we're talking about this today is France, just this weekend, brought in a new law that would ban smoking in public places where the public and particularly where children can gather. And that includes bus stops, beaches, stadiums, anywhere near schools, anywhere around libraries. And they brought in just at the start of the summer holidays. So just that, to protect kids on beaches and in parks where they'll be spending most of their summer, from people smoking and secondhand smoking. And also just to reduce that normalization effect of smoking that children see. And we think that if France had taken the lead on that, Ireland could follow suit and bring in a similar ban on public places here, which there is strong public support for that here in Ireland.
Yeah, that's what I was just going to say, that I'm sure there would be an appetite for that, particularly non-smokers. You know yourself, you're out somewhere and just that smell of smoke, you know, it just puts you off certain places, never mind, you know, it impacting you.
Absolutely. We know the HSE have done research on this, and 64%, so nearly two-thirds of the public, are in favour of extending a smoking ban to these kind of public places. But like that, we all know the dangers of secondhand smoking. So if you're at a beach or at a park and someone is smoking beside you, we don't want that. The smell is toxic. It's bad for your health. But also it causes a huge environmental damage as well. If you look across every local authority across the country, year on year, they do a litter survey. This includes Donegal or Dublin or any other local authority. The number one littered item in the country is still cigarette butts. So if we can reduce and ban smoking in these public places, it would actually have a huge environmental but also a public health benefit. And also you think about if you're a smoker yourself and you're looking to quit smoking, but if you're going to all these public places and you're seeing other people smoke, that's that kind of temptation to trigger you back in. So having these smoke-free spaces would actually support smokers who are looking to quit to actually successfully quit as well.
And do you think that they could phase it out by designating certain areas, say at a beach, that, you know, if you're a smoker, you can go here to smoke, you know, the way in, say, an airport, they can go to a designated area?
I think the danger, and of course, you know, this isn't very addictive substances, so it's not as easy for me to say just people should quit. It is a huge addictive substance, so I think that it is a valid concern. The issue is that if you have one rule or one place where smokers can't smoke and one place where smokers can't smoke, it does cause a lot of confusion. Mm-hmm. And at times, even the authorities or the public aren't sure which is which. So I think it's quite better. And the WHO, this is what they recommend, is to have one rule and that's it, no smoking here. Yeah. And keep it that straight. So that way it keeps it at an adherence and a proper enforcement.
And in terms of the enforcement, how would this process work? Have you thought that far ahead?
I think it is, again, that is a valid concern. And these kind of similar concerns were raised in 2003 and 2004 in the lead up to the workplace smoking ban, the historic workplace smoking ban. There was a lot of concern about, well, what happens if just everyone in the pub continues to smoke and every single pub has people smoking in them? The Gardaí aren't going to go around to each pub to throw them out. But the reason why that was so successful is because there was a huge level of public buy-in. The public just wanted it. The public saw the benefit of it and they supported it. So I do think if you brought something similar like this, there'd be a huge level of public support and public buy-in. And that would bring in itself kind of a public enforcement, kind of a social enforcement level to it as well. But also there will be, you know, the odd characters who would breach it. So we do need some enforcement and sanctions to keep that enforcement up. In France, you know, there is a fine for those who breach these bans, and that's going to be at €135. So I do think there should be a level of a similar level here. So whereby you have a bit of a carrot and stick approach, of the carrot of, you know, the public buying, but also the stick of a proper fee and enforcement, and, you know, proper resources going towards environmental health officers and the HSE, so they actually can police and enforce these rules.
And that €135, that's quite a hefty fine. So you would imagine that would be a good enough deterrent.
Absolutely. You know, it would be a huge deterrent to actually, why would a smoker even risk smoking at a bus stop if they know they could potentially be fined €135? And like that, it would just kind of invalidate the enforcement even more, knowing that it's a huge deterrent. So people wouldn't do it. So there's a number of ways that we can really enforce and deter smokers from doing it. And I think that's one of the key ways to do it.
And how do you see the government getting on board? Do you think that they would be open to this idea?
I think so. Last year, at the start of 2024, the government actually ran a public consultation on looking at further regulation of tobacco and e-cigarettes. And one of the questions was this question itself, you know, should the government look to extend smoke-free spaces to other areas and even extend the smoke-free spaces to cover both tobacco and e-cigarettes, which we would be in favour of as well. But, you know, just last week in Dublin, Dublin hosted the World Conference on Tobacco Control, this big global conference where it had academics, researchers, NGOs from around the world all come together to see how we can better enforce tobacco control. And Micheál Martin, Taoiseach Micheál Martin, actually gave the opening address there. And he said, taking action on tobacco control is a no-brainer. And I think that's so true. This is a no-brainer, and tobacco control is a no-brainer. So we're very lucky that we have a Taoiseach like Micheál Martin, who was the Minister of Health when the workplace smoking ban was brought in, to be such a strong supporter of tobacco action and e-cigarette action. And the same goes to say for the Minister for Health, Jennifer Carr-McNeill, again, a very strong supporter of tobacco and e-cigarette control. And I think what's really driving it is that the public, the Irish public out there have a strong appetite for tobacco and e-cigarette control. They know that tobacco has no place in our society. They know that the dangers and the harm cigarette smoke has on people's health. And even now on e-cigarettes, they know that they are purely targeting young people. So I think the Irish public and the Irish politicians are way ahead, and they want to see action on this. So I think there will be a lot of great level of support for this.
And how do you see, you talked about there that the public is aware of the dangers around smoking and vaping, and so many people have taken proactive approaches in terms of this, but how further do you think that banning smoking in certain outdoor areas would benefit people's health?
Well, first of all, I think it would denormalise the act of smoking. So we're seeing about the next generation of children and young people who look up to adults, look up to their peers. And if they don't see their peers or adults smoking, then they won't smoke. So it has a really good denormalisation effect. But also, secondhand smoke, even in outdoor settings, does have a health impact, particularly if you're a children or young person, because your body and your lungs are still developing. You're at much higher level of risk from smoking and secondhand smoking. But I think we have to look at, you know, a number of measures. It's not just a measure like this. It has to be kind of a suite of measures, you know, extending smoke-free spaces, but also we have to look to what's happening in the UK. The UK are very close to passing like world-defining legislation that would phase out the sale of cigarettes to anyone born after 2009, and that's going to be applied to Northern Ireland. And so we're going to get to a time on the island of Ireland where in the Republic we have one rule for tobacco, and then Northern Ireland we have another rule for tobacco. So I think we have to have a debate in Ireland about whether we should be following the UK in phasing out cigarettes for a certain age group. And I think we should. And again, the HSC have done research on this, and 83% of the public want to see a phase out of cigarette smoking. So I think it's not just one measure. There is no such thing as a silver bullet measure in tobacco control. So I think we have to look at a number of measures, all brought in together, all brought in with proper investment, proper resources and proper timeline to actually get that public buy-in. But I think the public are ready for this, and the public want to see the end of tobacco.
And it is important, that all-island approach, particularly, say, for us here in Donegal, you know, we're in, depending on what part of the county you're in, you're a matter of minutes from crossing over the border then as well.
Absolutely. Like, you guys know more than anyone else on the island of Ireland just how close you are to Northern Ireland, and the kind of the two rules, if they're not aligned, how it can kind of cause confusion and kind of cross-border trade and cross-border shopping. So I do think it's really important that we have alignment on these areas for a whole matter of reasons. But I do think there's a huge reason why Ireland should follow the UK. And again, this happens in a lot of ways. It takes for one country to take the lead and then other countries follow. So the UK will be taking the lead here. Ireland could follow. And once Ireland would follow, we'd be the first country in the EU to do so. And like that, we would set a precedent for other countries to follow, like the Netherlands, like Denmark, like Sweden, who are also talking about kind of a tobacco endgame. So there's a number of reasons why we should have an all-island alignment. And again, we have the public behind us.
One listener says the smoking ban in Ireland prohibits smoking in all enclosed workplaces, public buildings, restaurants, bars, clubs, offices, company cars, taxis and public transport. Is that not enough? What about my rights? But I suppose then it's what about the rights of the non-smokers then? You know, we don't want to be subjected to that secondhand smoke.
Absolutely. And again, we do have to think about people who smoke. You know, it is a very addictive substance. But I would probably go back to what the French minister said, who brought this piece of legislation in France. And she said tobacco must disappear from places where there are children. So I think the right of a children to breathe clean air and not to be exposed to secondhand smoke trumps any other right. The life and the health of a children trumps everything. So I think that's what we have to think about when we're talking about tobacco control measures like this.
Absolutely. Mark Murphy, Senior Policy Manager at the Irish Heart Foundation. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. Looking to some of your other comments that have been coming in on this topic. Do they expect us to just smoke at home? Smoking is also a very sociable thing. You meet fellow smokers on your break while having a chat. Some of my best nights out have been in smoking areas. Legislation should primarily focus on preventing genuine and significant harm. Given the rapid dispersion of smoke outdoors, the harm in open public spaces is often more about nuisance or preference than a direct health threat. Overregulating minor nuisances, I'm not sure which one that is, can breed disrespect for law. Smoking is a legal activity in a free society. Individuals should have the autonomy to make personal choices, including the choice to smoke, provided it doesn't directly and significantly harm others. Another listener says, I'd like to see it made illegal to smoke in your car with your kids. Yeah, I did think there was something around that, but maybe I'm wrong in relation to smoking with children in your car. I could have made that up, but yeah, I do think obviously the child has no choice but to inhale this secondhand smoke as well. Yeah, it's an interesting one. What do you think? 086 60 25,000. On the 1st of February 1979, Ireland introduced legislation that made the wearing of seatbelts mandatory for front seat passengers and drivers. 46 years later, and almost 6,000 Irish people are caught not wearing a seatbelt. Now, we are joined to discuss this by Cynthia Newmurky, MEP. Good morning to you.
Great to be speaking to you.
You too. This is no doubt very worrying. I thought we would be past this.
I certainly thought we'd be past it as well. When you mentioned that 1979 we introduced legislation, I kind of remember that. I was born in 66. So like I would have been in primary school at the latter end, and I remembered the seatbelts going into the car because prior to that we didn't wear the seatbelts and we slept in the back window of the car and we slept on the back seat of the car, and it wasn't all that safe. But of course, since then, we've had a huge increase in people driving on the roads, a huge increase in safety issues. And unfortunately, Michaela, we've had a huge increase in deaths. And the Road Safety Authority analysis shows, that I looked at, shows that Irish collision data proves that 22% of car users killed between 2019 and 2023, they weren't wearing a safety belt. So that's a huge percentage killed because of no safety belt. It's almost a quarter of people who are involved in collisions. And then unfortunately, people who are seriously injured in cars, it shows that 7% of them were not wearing a safety belt at the time of the collision. So it is the difference between life and death, and it is unfortunate. And I'm calling for more action in relation to the fact that, as you say, up to 6,000 people caught not wearing their safety belts in figures released by An Garda Síochána to me. Huge increase in Galway, 95%. Huge increase in Kerry, 72%. And huge as well in Waterford, 57%. Donegal actually fared out all right.
Yeah, Donegal was among the lowest in the county. 44 mm-hmm. prosecutions for not wearing a seatbelt mm-hmm. in Q4 of last year. That still is potentially 44 fatalities. That's the worrying point.
That is the worrying point. And we do know that 79 people have died on our roads as of June 2024 this year. It's slightly down on the same time last year, which was 81. But we're talking about cyclists and pedestrians and passengers and drivers. And think about, Michaela, all the families that are left behind to deal with the bereavements. And I know it only too well because, unfortunately, my own dad was killed while he was crossing the road many, many years ago. So, you know, in 1977, to go back to those 70s, those years in the 70s when the law was introduced, the deaths were seen in numbers of, you know, a couple of 100. But it has just grown exponentially. And we only have to turn on the radio or turn on the TV and we hear about a death almost as a daily occurrence. So, look, I think we need to up the Garda presence, and I know that Mr. Jim O'Callaghan is working hard on recruiting extra Gardaí, and obviously it will be difficult to have everybody who's not wearing a seatbelt detected by a Garda, by a person, but the tech is there now to detect those not wearing safety belts, such as it does in relation to speeding motorists, and the tech needs to be funded and needs to be rolled out.
And I suppose the question has to be asked as well, why is this road safety message not getting through? You discussed there, you know, an increase in Garda presence, but this is something that has been ongoing now for quite some time.
Yes, I think people feel or think they will get away with it. Now, Michaela, I don't know whether you've covered the drink driving aspect of road safety as well, but again, from what my constituents are writing to me about, people feel they can get away with drink driving, they can get away with speeding, they can get away with not wearing safety belts. So it is about the enforcement side of the law. And people need to know that they will be caught if they break the law. They will be caught. They will be brought before the district court, the circuit court or whatever court. They will be fined and prosecuted. But I think people feel that they won't be caught and they're simply taking a chance. In other cases, of course, and I would reach out to the listeners who would never dream of taking a chance and shouldn't dream of taking a chance, just listeners who might be under pressure with children strapping them into a safety seat or into a booster seat, just make sure you can operate the seat, that you give yourself time to actually clasp and belt in your child properly, because your child is so vulnerable, and particularly infants, make sure that they are positioned backwards in their safety seat.
And in terms of the prosecution, particularly in relation to not wearing seat belts, is there a high volume of prosecutions as well?
Yes, I don't have data for the high level of prosecutions, because I think what happens is when somebody is detected, when somebody is prosecuted, they tend to pay the lesser fine of €120 and get the three penalty points instead of facing an increased fine for non-payment, or indeed far more higher penalty points, five penalty points if it's brought before court and you're convicted. So they tend to get on with it and pay it. But the problem is that not enough people are being caught and detected and prosecuted for this.
And most of us now, the majority of cars, you know, have that beeping sound. You know, we've come a long way in terms of vehicles that even Bluetooth, you know, most cars, no matter what age they are, have Bluetooth and they have the seatbelt warning, that people are obviously just ignoring this as well.
Yes, and from what I'm hearing from my constituents, unfortunately, is that people are actually clasping the belt in. They're putting it into the clasp, but then they're sitting on it or they're putting it behind the seat. I mean, this is ridiculous type of behaviour. I don't know what is in people's heads, whether it's the heat, they want freedom, they want to just break the law, but they are costing lives and there should be no excuse for this type of bad behaviour, like speeding, like being distracted on your mobile phone, like doing other things, not indicating, not turning properly. Look, a motor car is a really, it's a really strong piece of equipment to have on the road. We know what kind of destruction it can wreak on people's bodies, on people's lives, and we need to slow down. And I mean that, I suppose, mentally, when we get to the car, we need to remind ourselves, look, I'm stepping into something now that has the potential to do damage. I need to slow down. I need to be conscious. I need not to be distracted. And I always say to people, look out as well for the youngsters who have to drive, because the connectivity in terms of transport is just not there in every county, especially rural Ireland, where I'm from, in Ireland South. So look out for the novice and the learner drivers, and look out for the older drivers as well. Because
it's about setting that example to younger drivers too.
Yes, absolutely. But I think, again, going back to the tech to detect people not wearing safety belts is what we need. But we also need tech whereby maybe the car wouldn't start if your safety belt is not engaged. Now, of course, it can be engaged behind the seat, so that may defeat it. But perhaps there could be a smart way of the safety belt and the tech indicating it's not actually placed across somebody's chest and therefore we can't start the car. A bit like the alcohol interlockers that I spoke about during the campaign last year when I was trying to get elected, which was to try and cut down on drink driving, which has been rolled out in several countries in the EU and has been successful. You simply can't start the car unless you blow into the interlocker and prove that you don't have alcohol on board.
And in terms of your role then as an MEP, do you believe that there needs to be Europe-wide regulation, or are there other parts of the continent that have something in place?
Yes, they do. The interlockers that I've spoken about and the detection of non-wearing of safety belts is there in other countries. Rules to do with road safety and transport are obviously a national competency, as well as getting regulations to do with travel that I've been working on. For example, air passenger rights in the case of a travel company going into liquidation, or travel rights for persons of reduced mobility. But once these directives are enacted in Europe, and can I just say, these directives and laws do have a meaningful effect on people's lives in Donegal, on people's lives down in my constituency in Ireland South as well. But it's then up to the member state to enforce them and to bring them into national law and to look at best practice around Europe. But unfortunately, there's no Europe-wide practice that can be agreed and implemented and, could I say, foisted upon a member state. An opportunity has to be given to the member state to actually enforce the directive or the law in the best manner it sees fit. And obviously, that will come down to budget and investment and recruitment and all of that. But I do know, and I have great faith in the present Minister for Justice, Jim O'Callaghan, because he's very committed to the justice brief and particularly to this area of road safety, as I am because I'm on the Transport Committee here in the Parliament.
And do you see this being something that could be implemented in the near future, or in relation to policy, will this take quite a while?
Well, I'm calling for it to be implemented, and I can't control the timeline. I can't control budgets, but what I can do is advocate for something that could be investigated, and not only could be, but should be, because if we're going to have a short-term shortage of An Garda Síochána, as we recruit them, we're in the middle of a recruitment drive, and it will take time to build up our stock to that extra 5,000 Gardaí in the country, then it is incumbent upon all of us legislators and lawmakers and politicians to be looking at other aspects and tools that are available to us. And we only have to mention the word AI, and we can see how much tech has progressed in the last 12 months, for example. So the tech is getting more and more sophisticated as time goes by. And really, I don't want more families to be left bereft without their loved ones. And I certainly don't want them left minding a loved one who is now confined to a wheelchair and maybe who cannot work, who has no independent mobility and so forth. Families are very badly affected.
And do you think that there is that responsibility further on the driver then? We know, we hear the ads about ensuring that all passengers are wearing seatbelts. This is a serious issue. And I suppose it safeguards, if there were to be a crash, that it safeguards all passengers then.
Yes, exactly. And again, look, we teach people to learn how to drive, and they do now the theory test and the actual practical test and all of that. But perhaps there should be retesting, and particularly for people who, again, are found in breach, not only of wearing safety belts and being prosecuted for that, but in terms of speeding or in terms of other offences, whether it's dangerous or careless or driving, they should be made to resit again and reminded, look, you cannot just adopt and maintain bad practices. But again, back to the tech, and I'm not a tech expert, but wouldn't it be great in terms of an accident if, you know, it could be detected as to who's wearing safety belts and who's not? It's mainly doctors who tell us that, because they know from the injuries that they examine and that they treat on the person that unfortunately is maimed or in bad circumstances has passed away as a result of the collision. But really, we should be, I suppose, advertising the message more. And in fairness to the RSA, they mounted several very successful campaigns. But I think we need to keep driving the message home on a daily basis.
Yeah. Fianna Fáil MEP for Ireland South, Cynthia Murphy, thank you so much for joining me this morning. Just give you a review of the Donegal figures there again. So Donegal had 44 prosecutions for not wearing a seatbelt in Q4 2024 alone. 30 people were prosecuted for not wearing seatbelts in Q3 2024 over a three-month period, and 54 people were prosecuted in Q2 2024 over a three-month period again for not wearing a seatbelt in Donegal. A couple of comments on that matter. Airbags are designed to work in conjunction with seatbelts. Without a seatbelt, an airbag can actually cause more harm than good, as the occupant is not in the correct position for the airbag to provide optimal protection. And another listener asks, what about people who are videoing themselves while driving for social media? Yeah, I do think that is crazy. And you see that more and more often now, people coming along, or people voice noting as well. Because sometimes it doesn't work through your Bluetooth, and you can clearly see somebody voice noting on their phone while driving along. Obviously, you know, nothing is more important than road safety. So whatever the voice note is, I'm sure it could wait. Accidents involving unbelted individuals often require more extensive emergency services, diverting resources from other potential emergencies, a listener says. If we introduced lifetime bans, it would be more effective. Yeah, obviously, there does need to be greater sanctions as it relates to that. It's just, what would be the biggest deterrent, as Cynthia Numerica was saying, you know, people are opting to just take the €120 fine and the three penalty points. So it's more or less a slap on the wrist, whereas opposed to if they were hauled before their courts and, you know, their names then out in the public, that would be maybe more of a deterrent to them. A listener says, I went online to book a few days away in Dunfanaghy for three adults on a four-day trip. Not one place was available under €1,000. It's ridiculous. Yeah, that's a huge cost. That would take somebody on quite a good holiday. Has anybody else had a similar experience? Have you priced somewhere locally and has it been absolutely astronomical in terms of price? We were talking about housing with Councillor Jerry McMonagle at the start of this show. A listener says, Jerry has referred to the crash in 2008 as a reason for Donegal County Council's failure to build social houses. He's referred to a lack of finance from government, and he's referred to defective blocks in the area causing delays. He has not referred to the fact that there has been a €4 billion housing fund available to the council to draw from since 2014. Councils must present plans to the Department of Housing to draw from that fund. In fact, the council did draw from that fund to purchase houses in Buncrana that it was aware had defective blocks. Jerry also failed to mention that the county development plans put forward over the past decade have all failed to have any social housing in them. So the council has serious plans to rebuild social housing. It's just excuse after excuse from the councillors, who have abject failed to deliver on social housing while in the middle of a defective block crisis. Another listener says, I lost my wedding ring of 36 years over the weekend in Dunfanaghy. Dunfanaghy, it's of great sentimental value. A reward is offered if found. It's a men's ring with an inscription. It was lost in Dunfanaghy, somewhere in the town, on Saturday or Sunday morning. If you come across, or you have already come across, a ring, get in touch with us here and we'll put you in touch with the owner. Joined now on the line by Emma Gova, the wee Donegal mammy. Good morning, Emma.
Good morning, Michaela. How are you?
I'm good, thank you very much. Unfortunately, we're chatting again about Letterkenny University Hospital, this time in relation to the emergency department. What was the situation there yesterday, Emma?
Do you know what? My heart went out to the staff yesterday. It was so busy. My daughter was taken in yesterday. Some of my followers know she has complex medical needs, and she became very unwell yesterday, and hats off to staff. They do always treat her with such care and dignity, and the doctors are, and nurses are fabulous with her, but I just felt so bad for them. You know, it was just trolley to trolley, chair to chair yesterday when we went in. And like, for example, the ambulance crew that was with us, they stood with us for 2.5 hours before they could hand off.
My God.
And there was just trolleys in front of us, trolleys behind us, with ambulance crews waiting to hand off. And you know, it's not, I want to stress, it is not any fault of the staff at all. There was just no beds. There was no cubicles available. I mean, at one stage, I counted 15 trolley chairs with people in them. inclusive of what was in the cubicles, and that wasn't including what was on the other side of the door in the waiting area. You know, and it's just, I don't know how to do it, to be honest, but, you know, something, when you listen to the likes of Dr. Michael Sugru, and he's top of his field, he's very, very highly qualified doctor, saying that we have 18 months before this hospital becomes non-functioning.
Yeah.
And we need to be taking this seriously. Because, you know, for example, Michaela was rushed in yesterday with back-to-back epileptic seizures. She'd had 5 seizures yesterday. And I thought to myself, if this hospital is non-functioning in 18 months' time and it becomes like Enniskillen, what happens? Where are we supposed to go?
Mm.
Where are we, you know, how are you going to blue light her to Sligo?
But I'm sure many would argue that already it's obviously not functioning. It's non-functioning in certain capacities. You know, you had to wait in an ambulance with your daughter before, you know, even care was provided.
Well, no, in fairness, we were taken straight into the ED.
Right.
Because she was unwell and we were in the corridor just outside of the resus department. And I have to say, from the minute we went in, the nurses and doctors were there. They were making sure that, you know, she was stable and that she was okay. And thank God.
So she was in the ED in total 2.5 hours, was it?
No, she was 2.5 hours on the ambulance stretcher before she was able to hand it over to the actual ED staff. Now, the ED staff, don't get me wrong, were coming up and down. They were, you know, doing blows, getting lines in. But you see, what people don't realise is that once the ambulance, well, some people don't realise, a lot of people do, is when the ambulance crew is there, unless there is a bed for their patient to go into or a trolley chair for their patient to go into, they can't leave their patient. So, for example, an ambulance was tied up with us for about 2.5 to 3 hours yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And that means 2.5 to 3 hours that ambulance can't go to another call.
Yeah, they're...
So if somebody's having a cardiac arrest in Malinhead, do you know what I mean? And it's not the ambulance crew's fault. But then that's what happens, is then that calls go to ambulance crews outside the county then, if there's none left in the county. But what happens in the next county then? When they, you know, it's just this knock-on ripple effect.
Yeah, an entire knock-on effect. And I know there was... one case where an ambulance was called and they were simply told that there was no ambulance available. And, you know, on that occasion, they were able to go to the hospital themselves. But, you know, there's plenty of issues and plenty of cases where, you know, say that cardiac arrest, for example, that, you know, you need that ambulance on the scene as soon as possible. And it's a life or death situation.
Well, for example, we were lucky that an ambulance was available for us yesterday. By the time the ambulance had come to us, she had already been 4 seizures in. And we were lucky they got to us pretty sharp. The GP service had called them. But what if they had been tied up with somebody else and we couldn't get that ambulance? Because, mm-hmm. you know, by the time we were travelling up the road, Michaela was cyanotic. Her hands were turning blue. Her mouth was turning blue. You know, we had sirens and blue lights going up the road. And I just dread to think what's going to happen now. And I've been listening all week, you know, as I'm doing my bits and pieces around the house, looking after the kids. And I have 4 children, 3 have additional needs, 2 have complex medical needs. And I was listening to Dr. Michael Sugru, and I've been listening to Dr. Angus Keaton, and listening to Greg discussing, you know, what's going to happen if we don't get the investment that's needed. And the reality is, Michaela, what's going to happen is it's going to cost lives. It's going to cost lives in Donegal. And I pray to God it's not my child's life it costs, because she has complex medical needs. And we don't have that. I wouldn't even say luxury. I don't like to use the word luxury for any patient travelling, you know. But for example, if I'm up going up and down to the hospital to her now, I am 20 to 25 minute commute from my home, right? I can go up and down. I can go back and forward and do what I have to do at home, as well as being in there looking after Michaela. But if this hospital becomes non-functioning, our next hospital is Sligo, that's turning my commute into 1 hour and 50 minutes each way. How in under God am I supposed to be able to travel up and down to my other children with additional needs, as well as give Michaela the care she needs? And in those situations where we have a really serious emergency, are we going to be an 1 hour and 50 minutes from the next functioning hospital in 1.5 years?
And you shouldn't have to live with that fear, you know. you mentioned their luxury. It isn't a luxury, but we should have access and timely access to care and the resources in place. But living then yourself with that fear, if a medical emergency should arise, where do you have to travel to?
This is what I thought last night. I saw a post shared by Greg Hughes saying that Michael Healy-Ray had confirmed that Marion Harkin had secured this hub for Sligo. Now, I have talked to all of our Donegal TDs at some point throughout the week about, you know, the real concerns that I have as a parent of children with complex medical needs and the concerns that other people have related. We had a woman reach out to me last week when after Marion Harkin had been on the radio show, and she had said to me her mother is 87 and she travelled out of the county once to Sligo for treatment and she's not fit to do it. She can't do it again. But the reality is these are the questions that we need answered. If we don't get this...
And it's a scary thought thinking, will that woman now... Will she just not receive her care? Will she make the decision, you know, she's not fit to travel the long distance?
Her daughter has said. Her daughter has said that she said she just will not go. You know, she's 87, she'll just take her chances. And, like, for the likes of us, as I said to my husband yesterday, I sat in the ED yesterday, and I have to be honest, the staff in the ED are absolutely amazing, you know, and they're so good to her. I have to be honest with you, they really are. Because they know her, and the care that they do give her, and I watched them treat her such dignity yesterday.
And that's also another reason, Emma, why you wouldn't want to go to another hospital. They're obviously aware of your daughter's care.
They know her and they're good to her, and the compassion and the empathy they show her. She had a heartbreaking condition and we watched her deteriorate over the years, and it's been horrible to watch her lose that independence. But they've always tried to treat her with such dignity and humanity. And to think that, you know, that we may not get that. And we're going to end up back at square one. These are people who have been treating her since she was a child, a baby. You know what I mean? And often have said to me, you know, is it amazing that she's got this far? And to think now that, you know, I'm supposed to start from scratch. And the real fear that I had yesterday in the pit of my stomach, I texted all our TDs last night and I said, you know, this decision isn't reversed, it's going to cost life. And I'm not saying that to scaremonger people, but I pray
the reality.
Because if we are an hour and 50 minutes away and she's five seizures in and she's turning cyanotic, are we supposed to go on to Sligo? What are we supposed to do?
Yeah, I know. It's.
And I would plead with those who are lobbying for the hospital, who have said, you know, that they're not going to throw in the towel. I spoke with Minister Charlie McConnell over on Saturday and he assured me that he was not thrown in the towel on this, and that you know, nothing had been set in stone, a decision had not been made. I spoke with Pat Cope Gallagher's office. I spoke with Charles Ward last night via text. I spoke with Pierce Doherty and Patrick McLaughlin's office during the week. And the thing is, I'm pleading with them and those on the health forum, if they're listening today, I am absolutely pleading with them to not play Russian roulette with my child's life. This is my child's life. And it's other children's lives, and it's mothers and fathers and sons. These are people's family members. They're not bargaining chips. These are people's loved ones. Our daughter is very much loved and valued member of our family, and I can tell you, I couldn't even bear thinking about her not being with us. So I am pleading with them, absolutely pleading with them, to not let this go. I mean, if there has to be a surgical hub in Sligo, then you know what? Then there's going to have to be one in that
area. Yeah, has to be two.
It's not just about the surgical hub. It's that if we don't get that investment, we can't attract the doctors. And if we can't attract the doctors, we will become downgraded.
Yeah.
And people like Michaela rely on this hospital as a lifeline. This hospital has saved her life on more than one occasion.
Yeah, and there's
the
so many.
And that hospital has saved her life on more than one occasion. And I dread to think what will happen if we don't have a functioning hospital within half an hour from us, because we can't make her 50 minutes if she's having multiple seizures, or if in the past she's had a respiratory arrest because of her epilepsy, or she's in respiratory distress. We don't have an hour and 50 minutes.
No, and Emma, you're not alone in this. There's so many people that are in the same situation and so many people living in fear. I know the Donegal doctors are meeting with the health minister later today, so we'll see what comes out of that. Thank you so much for joining us, Emma.
Thank you so much for your time, Michaela. I appreciate it.
That is Emma Gove there, the wee Donegal mommy. And as I said, she's definitely not alone in her concerns raised there. And the politicians within Donegal have committed to keep raising the need for the surgical hub to be located in Donegal. And we'll see what comes out of that meeting with Health Minister Jennifer Carol McNeill and the Donegal doctors later today. And we'll bring you that as we get it. Now, we continuously hear about the lack of electric vehicle infrastructure. So you would imagine a new car park being developed would include EV charging points, and that would have been at top of the priority list. I'm joined now by Councillor Michael McLafferty. Good morning, Councillor.
Morning, Michaela. How's things?
Good. But this, unfortunately, hasn't been the case in Dunfanaghy.
No. To be fair, Michaela, the background of things is here, the council developed a brilliant car park there in Dunfanaghy there a couple of years ago or so now. I think maybe 3 years this winter, actually. But anyway, the car park was done, so on, etc. A provision was left at the time for the possibility of two charging points. There is a facility there, or the wiring's there now for that. But then, when we looked into it then, after time went by, then there were no sign of charging points arriving. So I inquired into it then, what was happening to the charging points. And basically, between the council then and the ESB, it fell between two stools, because there's a huge amount of money involved here, apparently, to get this connected, upwards of towards 100,000, actually, to get them connected. And the reality is then just neither one was in a position then to pay for it. So where we stand at the minute, further on from inquiries to that now, I understand the council are seeking to see can they get funds to try and get it going, but that's where it's at the minute. But really and truly, Michaela, to be fair, I think when it's charging points, the ESB should step in and just pay for it.
And surely this cost should have been considered, you know, prior to the, you know, included in the plans for the car park.
It should have, Michaela, yes, but to be fair, I should have already agreed with you. But I think that was the elephant in the room when push come to shove. The cost was the problem at the end, up unknown to me, because obviously the car park was started then. Like, there was no flagging up of this at the time. We just assumed everyone was going to carry on, roll on like normal. And that wasn't the case then. When the car park was finished, then tired, everything else, I quickly released then, hang on here, there's no sign of these charging points coming. Mm-hmm. And when I questioned it then, queried it then, that was the problem then. Like, so as I say at the minute, I understand the councillors are trying to seek funding for it, but even at that could still be some time away. So obviously the ESB have washed their hands off it. They've thrown it back to the council. If the council can't get appropriate funding, we'll have no charging points.
And is there any other charging points in the Dunfanaghy area?
Not public ones. There will be ones here and there, possibly at private houses, but not public ones, Michaela, that you can pull into. Or certainly not public ones that I'm aware of, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Unless any business, I got one recent times unknown to me, on a private/public basis for customers, whatever. There's none that I'm actually aware of. The only other ones that I am aware of is the Wild Atlantic Camp there in Chrysler. Rorty's Atlantic Camp there in Chrysler for the caravan, so on. They have multiples of them there. Next to that then would be Fulcara Car Park, then Fulcara behind the Bank of Ireland. There's a couple of them there. Moving on from that then, the car park in Fulcara too, above Centre, there's one there as well. Moving on from that then, I'm not sure about Guidoor, Dunlow, I understand.
If you had an electric vehicle and you were visiting Dunfanaghy, you couldn't effectively charge your car there. That's the way it stands.
That's
at the minute.
That's the bottom line, and it is hampering hell, Michaela, out of things with the Wild Atlantic Way, obviously. And this is actually a bit of a fall down the whole way along the Wild Atlantic Way. Speaking to people there last week as well, people from Belfast and that were visiting here last week as well, we had a long conversation about EV points, charging points, etc., electric cars. And they were seeing, even for themselves up around home, they're grand and around Belfast generally and around the north, so they're okay, providing you're in the city. But mm-hmm. if you leave the city, then go from Belfast to some other city along run, again, it falls down too, rurally. There's no charging points along the way. It is a big problem, and it's not helping ourselves tourist-wise. it's not helping West Donegal tours-wise, because people going from wherever, as I say, landing here, people landing here not planning their route, although I'm sure pretty much now most people will. But for the odd ones that don't, like for example, I've heard Donal there mention yourselves, your own colleague, several times about, I think his own brother's Olympic year, and he goes from Dublin to wherever they live at. There's no problem at all because of plenty of charging points on the route that he uses. But that's not the case here in Donegal. It's not the case in the Wild Atlantic Way. And the other problem is here as well, Michaela, too.
And is this something that, I know we're talking about Dunfanaghy specifically, but has the council made any progress on, you know, including plans for additional EV charging points?
No,
right across the county?
Not that I'm aware of. The big thing is here, Michaela, the whole thing with EV charging points, you recall a few years ago, the government gave a commitment that time that they were to roll out, I think it was 1,100 charging points right across the country. Once that was mentioned then, well, obviously, every local authority then, or whoever it may be, business person alike, is depending then on this statement then of the 1,100 charging points being rolled out. So they're going to hold back then on that. That hasn't happened. I would say, as this be told, they're going to roll out 150 at this stage and remain 1,100. And it is causing huge problems. The other problem is as well here with the electric car too, Michaela, as you know, two problems actually. Number one, it takes a long time to charge it. Yeah. On a public point, it could take 40 minutes to charge it. Secondly to that then as well, the more electric cars you get in the area, the more pressure is putting on the grid. I was speaking to an engineer there last night, and he was saying to me, if the electric charging points or the electric cars increase by another 1% percentage in sales, it'll put that much power or that much demand apparently on the grid locally that the grid won't hold it, won't stick it, and it's gonna cause problems. It could lead to blackouts and so on. This is the reality. Our infrastructure here, our electricity.
Yeah, right across the board, it's not ready to facilitate this.
No, not. Unfortunately, no. While people may agree with electric cars, they're a good job for those that have them, and I'm sure they enjoy to have them, but for the likes of ourselves here early in Donegal, they're no go. The hybrid is a much more attractive by at the moment for many people here living rurally, because at least if the electric runs out, you have the backup of the petrol itself to get you to wherever, A to B and so on, or at least another petrol station. I had a situation there one night too where a lady ran out. She had 40 miles left on her dashboard of electricity, and her 60 miles to her journey, and only for a guard helped her. She wasn't bothered, like she was going to be left in the middle of nowhere. You know, 2 o'clock in the morning. This is the kind of mad stuff going on. Like
A listener says, the cost of 100,000 euros seems excessive. How can that cost be justified? Is this the cost for the installation and the wiring up of all EV charging points?
Well, I don't know. That's the cost. That's what Dunfanaghy's facing anyway. I can't speak about them all.
And was this for the one or the two?
For the two of them.
For the two of them.
Like, that's what's facing for Dunfanaghy anyway. Like, I can't speak on them all.
Yeah. But 50,000 euro each it's quite a cost.
Yeah. But this is the mad stuff like that's going on, Michaela. This is why the country's in a mess the way it is at the moment. It's a free for all. Like, if you're dealing with a specific commodity, the sky's the limit what you can ask for it. And that's unfair too. Like, but it's also very unfair to people bought into this facility at the end of buying electric cars and everything else is the way to go. Many people bought them on the prejudice that just we're going to have points right around every corner. That's not the case.
No.
It's going back now to bait people, obviously.
Well, Michael, hopefully ESB or the council comes up with the funding there, because obviously it's vital in the area. Ciarán Luaidhe of the Glenties Municipal District, Councillor Michael McLafferty, thank you for joining me. That's it for the 9 till noon show this morning. Thanks to Carling Orr and Shannon Wilkin for all their help on the show. John Breslin is up next on Around the Northwest, and we'll be back tomorrow.